So welcome. Good evening. This is the final class of our four-week discussion on the four greatest or most important verses in the Torah. And so the rabbis, figuratively, were sitting around and having this discussion. And one rabbi said, they weren't actually sitting around the same table necessarily, but it's recorded in this way. And so the first rabbi said that love your neighbor. You must love your neighbor as you love yourself. That's the translation that we have here at the Kaplan, the Living Torah. And he said that's the most important. That's klal gadol b'Torah. That is the great, great principle. Came along another rabbi, Ben Azai, and he said, nope. It's the verse that says, he made him in the likeness of God. That man is created in the likeness of God. That is the greatest one. And then it was Ben Zoma who said, nope, listen Israel, here God is our God, God is one. And then came along Shimon ben Pazi, who said, I think you all got it wrong. Really, the most important verse is one sheep in the morning and the second sheep in the afternoon. That's it. That is the most important verse in the Torah. And the rabbi said, Shimon ben Pazi is onto something. He's right. And the conclusion of the rabbis was that Shimon ben Pazi got it right. So this verse trumps all the other verses. And that's the unanimous decision. That's kind of the way the Talmud leaves it. And so the question that we have been pondering is, first of all, what does it mean to be the greatest verse? Why are any of these verses the greatest verses? Some of them seem to stand out as obvious candidates for being the greatest verse. And we've explored each one, trying to uncover what was really behind the verse and seeing why it would be the greatest one. But this one, by all accounts, is the most difficult for us to see why it would be the most important one. One sheep in the morning, one sheep in the afternoon. Number one, it was a sacrifice in the temple. Only the priests were involved in that. The average Jew was not involved in the sacrifices. All he did was donate to it. There was a mandatory tax, the half shekel tax that they would give, and that half shekel tax would be used for the purchasing of the sheep, one sheep in the morning, one sheep in the afternoon. This only really happened during the times of the temple. Today we don't have a temple, we don't have a morning sacrifice, sheep sacrifice, or an afternoon sacrifice. Besides, Peter would be out there protesting. And so why and how could Shimon ben Pazi even think that this would be the most important verse? Even more surprisingly is not only did they not laugh him out of the yeshiva, but they actually all agreed with him. And so obviously, there's got to be more to this verse, or to what's going on here. As to why Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi would think that this is the most important verse. So the videos that I chose, that I thought would really sum it up, kind of set the tone for why it is the most important. So the first video, we saw a fellow who wanted to go to Israel. He wants to make Aliyah. He wants to go to Israel. He wants to help out the people in Israel. We know Jewish people have always wanted to go back to Israel. It's one of the greatest mitzvahs to go back to Israel. It's such an amazing thing. And he, you know, proudly is, you know, he's volunteering his time. He's retiring, and he's going to donate his time and his money, and his kids are going to get a better education. It's all better. It's all better. It fulfills all of the, you know, all of the commandments, the great commandments. And he comes in and the Rebbe says, are you asking for a blessing or are you asking for an opinion? Which, by the way, that in itself is an amazing insight. When we ask God for a blessing, are we asking God for a blessing or are we asking for an opinion? It says that God leads people along the path they want to go. So if a person says, you know, I want a blessing for something and it's not necessarily good for you, God may give you the blessing. You may be allowed to go. In other words, had they said to the Rebbe, no, we don't want your opinion. We just want your blessing. He would have given them a blessing he wouldn't have said anything. He would have just given his blessing, which is why many times the fact that the Rebbe gave a blessing to something didn't necessarily mean that he agreed with it or that he would have recommended it. But as long as it wasn't illegal, immoral, or ungodly, he didn't mix in. If you asked him his opinion, okay, then he'd give you his opinion. So he asks the fellow, he says, do you want my opinion or do you want my blessing? And he prefaced it by saying, I'm warning you, you may not like my answer. The answer may be no. And you've already made the decision. You've already figured it all out. You've figured your whole life out. You're now ready to retire, ready to move to Israel, ready to move on with your life. You've got it all planned out. Now, will you take my advice and maybe change what you're about to do? Now, this is a fellow, the Rebbe knew who to talk to. The Rebbe knew his customers. And so he had a very long-standing relationship with Peter Combs. Actually, there's a book that I have in my house of his correspondence, his letters back and forth with the Rebbe. So the Rebbe knew that this is a person who could handle what he was about to say. And the Rebbe basically told him that no, he shouldn't go. He's absolutely, adamantly opposed to him going to Israel. Why? Because he has a job that he has to do. And although he thinks that it would be better for him to go there, but as a famous story with the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad leader, a chassid once came in asking for a whole bunch of blessings. I need this, I need this, I need that, I want this, I want that. And so the Rebbe realized that this fellow needed a little correction there. So he says, what you need, you're obviously very clear. But what's needed from you, I haven't heard you ask. What are you needed for? And so the Rebbe was saying, do you want to know what you're needed for? Where you are best suited, it's where you are. You're an influential person. You can make a difference where you are. You will make less of a difference if you go to Israel. Not that you shouldn't go to Israel. Not that people shouldn't go to Israel. Not that people shouldn't make Aliyah. That was not the Rebbe's point at all. If there was anyone who encouraged people to go to Israel, the Rebbe himself said that he was responsible for more people to make Aliyah single-handedly than any other person. So the Rebbe was very encouraging of people to move to Israel. But he was very careful as to who should move to Israel. Were they running away from their responsibility, or were they truly going to be blessed and truly going to be reaching their potential by moving to Israel? And so if someone was going to Israel and they were running away from what they really needed to do, the Rebbe called them on it. And so here was a fellow, the Rebbe told him, you have a responsibility, this is what you need to do. So the first point of this verse is that. The point of what are you needed for? So all of the other verses, we love God, love your neighbor, all those other things, those are all maybe secondary. You first have to come to the realization that you are needed for something. As opposed to what do I need? What are my needs? Well, I would love to be in Israel. I mean, love to. It would be great. It's my children would get a better education. I mean, it would be better for me. But the question is, what are you needed for? Maybe God needs you for something. And so that's one thought. The second thought is the second video. The second video is this young girl who has, apparently, this is her third or fourth time. She's had a private audience. Like, the Rebbe has almost nothing better to do with his time than to spend time with these young people and talk to them about, you know, so we're dating this one, dating that one, what's wrong with this one, what's wrong. He's playing the, you know, he's basically very involved in these people's lives. And she is, you know, this one's not for me, and this one's not for me, and this one's not for me. And the Rebbe realized that what she was looking for was something that maybe she needed some correction on, that maybe that's not what she should be looking for. And the Rebbe basically corrected her, or tried to inspire her to understand what real love is truly about. True love, how does one, what is true love? Is true love a feeling? You know, we had this actually the first evening where we talked about love your neighbor as yourself. What does it mean to love? What does it mean to have true love? And so most people think that love is a feeling that you have. And it is. It is a feeling that you have. And that when you encounter that person and you have that feeling, then you know you have met the right person. Well, sometimes that works, but sometimes even though you fell in love, you fall out of love. What happened? How could you possibly fall out of love with the person who you're supposed to be with? And how is it possible to build love, true love? And so the Rebbe's answer was that love is when two people have an understanding and have a tiny flame. So it has to be something. You can't take two people who don't have an understanding and marry them off and hope that something's going to happen. They have to have an understanding, and they have to have a tiny flame. What does it mean, a tiny flame? An attraction. They must have a little bit of attraction. That's flame. A tiny flame, a little attraction between two people. So, yeah, I'm a little attracted to him. I mean, yeah, we seem to be on the same page. Do I love him? No. So I can't marry him. I mean, he's just not for me. Because I'm not feeling it. I'm not feeling the love. And the Rebbe corrects her and says that that's not how it works. How it works is, it's two people who come together and do small acts. And the Rebbe even uses the word daily acts. One sheep in the morning, one sheep in the afternoon. That's the recipe. That's the recipe for true love. It's little acts, yes, one sheep in the morning. One. It's not like they brought the whole, they brought something small, but it was small acts, small, tiny acts of love. And before you turn around, that turns into true love. Then you have a lasting true love. And so what does this verse mean? What is this verse really telling us? It's called commitment. It's about commitment. Love is about commitment. The daily commitment. The daily grind. That's where it's at. The daily grind. We had a discussion last week whether actions are more important than feelings or faith or intellect. Are actions important because of what they show? Are actions important because they lead to something, because they show our love? But when you want to show your love for someone, and so you do an act of love, and not such a big act of love of buying flowers or taking them on a vacation or buying them a gift on their birthday. You know, those are like the people put a lot on those. You know, they put a lot of eggs in that basket, as opposed to the daily acts of love, which are the grind. So, what's more important? Is it what we think and feel, or what we do? that's most important. So it's interesting that Jesse and I have been talking about this for a long time. And we actually called our last course Habits of Faith. Jesse likes to say, you're saved, now what? Or, you have faith, now what? Or, you don't have faith, now what? You know, some people think that, well, I'm not religious, or I'm not orthodox, or, you know, I don't believe. Actually, I was talking to someone last night, and he said that, you know, he really didn't believe, but then he saw the light. He was on the hospital, in the ER, and he had some kind of big bypass surgery, and he crashed. And as he crashed, he didn't know what was going on, but he sees this long tunnel, and he saw this light at the end of the tunnel, and he was getting closer and closer and closer to the light, and all of a sudden he felt himself being pulled back from that light, and then he doesn't remember anything. And when they told him that he basically had crashed and he was gone, and then they shocked him back, so he realized that basically he saw the light, meaning that's where you go, and so after that, okay, now he's a believer. So everybody's waiting for that event to happen. So what's interesting is the Talmud says that it's possible to have a thief on the threshold of a door he's about to break into, and he offers a prayer to God, asking God to help him. So here's someone who has deep faith, or at least seems to have deep faith, and yet is praying to do something which is completely inconsistent with his faith. If you believe in God, what are you doing stealing? And so people who see the light, many times they're now convinced that there is a God, but doesn't necessarily change their life. So I'm saved, or I believe, or whatever it is, but I'm still the same person. I still live exactly the same way, except now I believe. Now I'm a believer. And so that's why this verse is so important. This verse says, it's the grind. It's what you do that's most important. That's how you develop real faith. That's how you develop real love with God, is in the actions that you do. So as much as you think you love your spouse, or you love someone because you saw them, or because you just had this, you know, the fireworks were going off, that might be just the beginning. That might be just what gets the two of you together. And you don't even need that. All you need is a tiny flame. What you need to build real love and real faith is the small, tiny actions that you do daily. And so the consistency in the commitment, the consistency to do it every morning and every afternoon, that's what does it. The accumulation of those small acts every single day bring the person to a place you could never, ever go on your own. And so a relationship will never get to a place, to the highest place that it could go, without the daily sacrifice, without the daily morning sacrifice and afternoon sacrifice. A relationship can never reach its true potential, cannot reach the true love that there is. So as much love as you have already, you haven't reached the top. You haven't reached the top of the summit. You haven't reached the top of the mountain. There is still more. And the same thing with faith. As much faith as you think you have, put in the daily grind. It's that consistency. And that really, if you want to think about it, is really the most difficult part of any relationship. That is the challenge. That's where your love is really being put to the test. That's where your faith is really being put to the test. Because it's that daily grind that discipline that is the most difficult part for us. It says that a person was created with the nature of not wanting to have a yoke on them. Just like a stallion or a wild horse that doesn't want to be broken in. That's the nature of the human being. The nature of the human being is we love to volunteer. We love to do things on our own terms. But to have to do something and to do it on a daily basis or twice a day, that's something we just, it just, you know, you tell a, it's like when you, you know, if my, if your spouse tells you to do something, asks you to do something, and they're so appreciative and they're so thankful, yeah, I love doing it. Make it my job? Ooh, you have just touched a raw nerve in me. Don't make it my job, okay? It's not my job. As soon as you make it a responsibility, as soon as you make it a restriction, some kind of confinement, oh, they want to run. That's what happens with children. As they get a little bit older, that's, you're telling me, Mom, you're telling me what to do again. Stop, you know, stop telling me what to do. I don't want anyone to tell me what to do. I want to do my own thing. And so getting into a relationship with someone, and especially getting into a relationship with God, this is the most challenging part. The most challenging part is getting over that. Getting over that part. I love my relationship with God. It's so wonderful. I'll make the terms. I'll decide when to do it, when not to do it. And the same thing with my spouse. I'll choose the terms of how this relationship should go. I'll decide if it should go this way, that way. You don't tell me what to do. No one should be telling me, right? I'll tell you what I need. Don't tell me what I'm needed for. And so this is really the most difficult, most challenging part of the relationship is the grind. That's the hardest part. That's the most difficult part. And so that's why Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi, in his wisdom, said, this is it. Yes, you'll have all the faith in the world. You'll be the most loving person in the world. But it's all you. You need to do the daily grind. Then you're going to grow. Then you're going to move. Then you'll be able to truly achieve faith in God. Then you'll truly be able to reach and achieve love your neighbor as yourself. Then you'll truly be able to recognize the likeness of God in yourself and in others. But if you don't get down to the grind, then it really hasn't penetrated you. It's like the thief standing on the threshold about to go in, and it's not penetrating. It doesn't really penetrate him. He hasn't absorbed the idea truly and fully. He's fooling himself into thinking that he believes in God. He's fooling himself to think that praying to God is going to help him in his act of thievery. He's fooling himself. And the same thing with our love of another person and our love of God and our faith in God. Are we fooling ourselves or not? Have we truly reached the highest level of faith? How do we get there? The answer is one sheep in the morning and one and a second one in the afternoon. That's how you do it. And that takes you there. And so, if we talked about this also in the first class, all of these high ideals that we've talked up until now, these are beautiful ideals. Very nice to talk about them, to pontificate about them, to write papers on them, to write theses on them, to inspire ourselves. But ultimately, we're going to remain pretty much the same. Okay, maybe our knowledge has grown. Maybe our thinking and our understanding of God has grown. But have we really grown? Has our relationship really grown? Has our love for God truly grown? Has our faith in God truly grown? Well, until we get into the grind of one sheep in the morning and the second sheep in the afternoon, we haven't really started that process. So how does it work? Why does it work like that? Why is it that I have to do one sheep in the morning and a second sheep in the afternoon. Why? Can't there be another way? Can't there be a shortcut? I mean, this is the most difficult way. I mean, it goes against my nature. It goes against my grain. Especially, I grew up in America. America is a land of the free. I mean, you're going to tell me I have to do this. I have to do something on a daily basis. Forget it. It's just, you're talking to the wrong crowd. You've missed it. Go talk to the people in Russia, Europe, somewhere else. I don't know where they're more socialist, you know. But this is capitalism. This is freedom. This is free. We are free people. Talk to me. There's got to be another way. There's got to be a Google app that will help me with this. You know, there's got to be something there's got to be another way. Why did God design it this way? Seems so unfair. I mean, these are just lofty things. Why do lofty things have to be grounded in grind? I mean, it should be somewhere else. I mean, it seems so petty. It seems so insignificant. Why is there such importance placed on such small things, like praying every day or three times a day and saying those words in the prayer book and studying the Bible every day? I mean, come on, yeah, we got the ideas, I got it, you know. I read the Bible, I went to school, you know, I heard it, I know the stories. I mean, come on. Why? So we have a deep concept in Jewish mysticism called Sof Maaseh B'machshava Techila. The last action is rooted in the highest part of the mind. Highest part of the person. What does that mean? That means that the lower something is, the higher its source. Why in the world did God bother to create this world? Intellect, angels are smarter than us. Faith, they have more faith than us. Spirituality, way more spirituality. Peace is everywhere except here. So why didn't he stop at the world just before ours? And why did he go ahead and do this world? Was this some kind of a mistake? Or was this some kind of an experiment that went bad? What was God thinking when he made this world? Yes, God loves humor, right? He has a sense of humor. So why does God create this world?
It was a challenge.
Oh boy, it's a challenge.
But you've told us it's a place where he can live.
He wants a place to live here, but he could get all those things in much greater measure and much easier everywhere else. This is the most challenging place to get all of that. You know, we want to bring about world peace. Yeah, there was peace. There's peace in the spiritual worlds. The answer is that there is something that is achieved here that cannot be achieved anywhere else. This lowest world, the world of action, stimulates and touches the deepest part of the person. And therefore, the deepest part of God. And this is the deep mystical secret behind this verse. One sheep in the morning and a second sheep in the afternoon. It's about the lowest part of the world we can get to. Taking an animal. What did they do with the animal, by the way? It was a burnt offering. Completely burnt. They took the animal, they slaughtered it, they put it on the altar, and burnt it. Has anybody ever been around when an animal is burnt? No. Smells awful. God-awful. Terrible. They burn the bones. Have you ever smelled bones being burned? Hair being burned. Have you ever smelled that? It smells so bad. It has no good smell to it. Terrible. Terrible smell. So it obviously wasn't being done. You know, you go into, our little baby's birth. So someone brought over a whole bunch of aromatherapy, lavender, and a whole bunch of different ones. We had like four different ones. And we had someone who was there with us helping Basi and kept on lathering up our hands with this oil. And the room, I mean, it was intoxicating. It was so strong in the room. It's all for the mind to calm the person down. And not only that, but every time the door was open, that the scent was wafting into the halls. And all of the nurses were coming by like, what is going on over here? Oh, this smells great. They all wanted to come into the room because it was just a really, really great and amazing scent. And it really, you know, you breathe it in. It just, that's aromatherapy. I mean, it's therapy through the smelling, right? Through the senses of the of breathing. And so we had it. It was the concept of incense. They took all of these beautiful things, and they put it together to make it smell nice, pleasant, make you into a spiritual, and get you into a spiritual mood, spiritual place. But the one act that the Jewish people did that was honestly the most grinding activity they did was this sheep sacrifice. Was it was the bottom of the totem pole. It gave no good smell. It didn't make you feel good. Nobody ate anything. It was like just an act, a pure act. It was like action. You know, we talk about action, so there are some actions that have emotion connected to it, intellect connected to it. This was action on the lowest level. And this, God says, this is the most pleasant scent before me. That's what it says. It says, Reach Nichoach. This is a pleasant smell for me. Now, God doesn't have a sense of smell like we do. If he did, he wouldn't like the smell anyways. So what does it mean it was a pleasant, now this really smells good. The idea is like this. Smell revives the soul. It touches us the most deepest. So when a person passes out, and you're calling their name, and you're trying to revive them, you put a little smelling salts under them, some really strong things. I know on the on Yom Kippur, when it's the fast day, I remember these have smelling salts. And if you're feeling a little faint, pass it around. They give you these smelling salts. And it really makes you, it really gives you like a, well, not like you had a meal, but it definitely fills you up. It really gives you energy. Why? Because the sense of smell is the closest sense that we have to the soul. Hands, feelings, eyes, ears, mouth. The one sense that we have that is closest to the soul is our nose, the smell that we have. Right? God breathes life into us through the nostrils. So what does that mean? That if you want to touch the person's soul, it's through his nostrils, through his breath. If you want to touch God, let's use it figuratively, metaphorically, anthropomorphically speaking. If we want to touch God, we touch God through his. How do we touch God's soul? How do you touch his soul? You touch his soul through God's nostrils. Obviously, God doesn't have physical nostrils. We're talking figuratively speaking here. But it's that concept. What touches God the most? What gets to God the most? The action that we've done. The act, the simple act, because God said, do this for me. Do me a favor. In the morning, make me a sheep. In the afternoon, offer a sheep. That's what I want you to do for me. And when we do that every day, it touches God and it touches us. So our sense is changed the most by the actions that we do. So if someone wants to change, I would like to change, I want to become a new person. So there's many ways that I could change, or I could try to change. Talk to the person, talk to his head, talk to his mind, talk to his heart. We'll try to engage him. That's just getting his attention. But how do you actually change? How does someone really, really change? I heard from someone, from a therapist. I don't know how true it is, but this is what I heard. It sounds right to me. That's why I'm repeating it. But she said that if you do something 5,000 times, 5,000 times, then it becomes your second nature. In other words, if you want to change your nature, do something 5,000 times. Do something. In other words, you want to change a nature, which is something inside of you, do something 5,000 times. I watched a show, a presentation by Malcolm Gladwell. The Tipping Point, right? He wrote The Tipping Point and The Outliers. So in his interview about The Outliers, he says that he interviewed all of these, or he did research on these famous people, extraordinary people, and he found that almost all of them put in what he called the 10,000 hours. But that whatever they did, and they did really well, they had done it for 10,000 hours before they became known for that, for whatever talent it was. He said, like the Beatles, gave an example. That they had been, from when they were 15 years old, they had been performing in Europe. Nobody knew this, but they were performing in Europe 8 hours a day for months on end before they ever came and tried and started performing here. So by the time they started performing here, they had already been doing it for 10,000 hours. I just read yesterday the Hayom Yom, the thought for the day. I'm not sure which day it was. And the Rebbe writes, it's a book where the Rebbe writes a thought for each day. He wrote it for 1 year. And the thought that he wrote on one of these days was that the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Chabad leader, recorded that he had studied the first Chabad Rebbe's discourses. He recorded that he had finished 32,000 hours of study. Wow. So if 5,000 acts change your nature, 10,000 hours makes you into, now you're an expert at whatever it is that you're doing. And 32,000 hours is, you know, that means that the hour by hour by hour, the doing. If you did it for a week, it wouldn't make a difference. Did it for 2 weeks, also doesn't make a difference. 3 weeks, not much. It's not, you haven't gotten close to your 5,000 hours, let alone to your 10,000 hours. Which is why God says in the Torah, sheep in the morning and a sheep in the afternoon. Okay, you start that when you're little, just do it. Every single day, just do it. Do it every day. Don't wait till you have some kind of a great epiphany. Don't wait till the fireworks start. Don't wait. Start. And you'll see. Just have faith. Trust. One action, and what happens cumulatively over time, it truly transforms and changes the person. That is probably one of the most reliable and probably the truest way to truly change a person, to truly develop a relationship, to truly develop one's faith in God. It's through the actions that we do. And so as much as you think you love, as much as you think you have faith, as much as you think that you have whatever it is you have, by doing small actions, you will see that slowly but surely you'll see your life turn and change in ways you could never have imagined it possible, because it isn't possible to do it any other way, and it takes a long time for that to happen. And so it's really in the action is where it's at. That's the way God created the world, because the action has the ability, because it really touches the deepest part of the person, to truly change the person. So when you're in, when you're engaging the mind, that's not the deepest part of the person. You haven't touched the deepest part of the person. When you engage the heart, you haven't engaged the most important part or the deepest part of the person. When you engage the even the deepest parts of the person, you haven't really touched the deepest part. But when you do the action, even if it's a seemingly meaningless action to you at the moment, you don't even feel it. It's not doing anything for you. That is touching the deepest part of your soul. But it takes time. It takes time. And slowly but surely, cumulatively, it actually makes a difference in your life. And so that is really the trick, the tip, the advice for how to truly transform oneself. And so therefore, yes, of course, love God and love your neighbor and have faith. Those are, of course, those are the most important ideals, the most important values. But how do you get there? If you don't have the commitment and the consistency of the action, you're bound to be stuck and not truly achieve what God has in mind for us. And so that's why Judaism is filled with action, filled with deeds. It's all about deed, and most here, more and more and more. I mean, if you think about it, most of Jewish literature is about what to do and what to do and how to do. And we spend so much of our energy and collective effort as a people developing what we're supposed to do. We have volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes about how to tie your shoes and how to go to the bathroom and how to take a shower and how to pray in the morning, in the afternoon, how to say this and how to write that. And how to do it. We get down into the nitty gritty of life. There isn't one part of life that we haven't attacked with a fine tooth comb to develop every single deed associated with that. It's only recently that we have become obsessed in a positive way with developing the love and the feeling behind it. But for centuries, for generations, we were obsessed with the action. Why? Because intuitively, we know, because God told us, that this is how we truly reach the highest parts. Now, obviously, we need to engage the other parts as well. And that's why we're not saying that this is the most important verse and all the other verses are not important. No, we have to develop our faith, our love, our emotions, all of those things. But we can't forget what Shimon ben Pazi says is the most important part, is the commitment and the consistency. And so it's never too late to start. It's never too late to begin. Today is the best day to begin. To pick one thing, to pick something, whether it's studying the Bible every day, whether it's praying the Shema every day, whether it's giving charity every day, just as simple as it sounds, having the discipline, whatever it is, to give the charity every day. It seems so simple. I mean, come on, I give a lot of charity. I give thousands of dollars to charity. I have to give every day a penny to charity? I mean, it's unbelievable. It is truly remarkable how different your life will be if you actually take upon yourself to give a penny to charity every single day, except for Sabbath. Well, that's about praying, right? This is an allusion to prayer, right? This is the obvious meaning behind this verse is about prayer. It's really the sacrifices. Prayer is in place of sacrifices. So the prayer in the morning and the prayer in the afternoon is really in place of the sacrifices. But you would not believe how your life will change. It takes a long time. And the same thing with prayer every day. You have no idea how much it changes the person by making the commitment of praying on a daily basis. Twice daily, even better. Three times daily, now you're on fast track. You know, so once a week, or once a month, or once a year, now you need to live to 7,000 in order to accumulate all of that. You know, you have to live a long, long time for an action once a year or twice a year, or three times a year, or five times a year, or 20 times a year, for it to truly have its effect. But if you do it every day, twice a day, the effect is tremendous. And it really is the deepest part of love. Because only someone who truly loves can really get themselves to do the grind. And therefore, it's the greatest sign of love, the greatest sign that you're willing to do what it takes to truly love someone else and to truly love God. Okay, we've said a lot of things and hopefully sparked some thoughts. So we'll see if we can collect our thoughts for a few moments and see if we can come up with, if you have some questions or thoughts to try to even make this clearer. Yes, Steve.
Was this verse in Numbers translated literally from the Hebrew, or is there some idiomatic commentary that was put into it, changing what was there to some sheep?
Nope, it says sheep.
So it's literally...
Does it say sheep, or does it say the word for sheep or goat?
It says keves, which is a sheep. Yes.
The other generations lost it because they weren't doing anymore? I mean, so each generation has to learn on its own, and because of the break and the move and the issues that happen in our lives, you know, people moved to America, got dispersed, the next generation wanted to assimilate, and we lost the daily grind. So it was taken from us, basically, and now we don't have our ancestors around to say, this is how you do it, this is what you do, this is what you need to do. You know, we're telling our kids, these are the chores you need to do. But we didn't have anyone telling us, this is what, you know what I mean? It's like, is this what happened to us, basically?
That's an excellent question. And it really makes you think. So what did happen to that generation? What happened to the generation that did do the grind? How come they weren't successful with their children? How come they weren't able to pass that on to the next generation? So they seemingly had it. And that's why I said that you can't have one verse to the exclusion of all else. And so when deed became the be-all and end-all of what it meant to be Jewish, that was its downfall. In other words, when you divorce it from everything else that Judaism has to say, when you divorce it from the spiritual side of Judaism, when you divorce it from the intellectual side of Judaism, when you divorce it from the emotional side of Judaism, then it just falls flat. And so that's what happened. What happened was they worshiped the deed as opposed to seeing it as the act of love it really needed to be and really understanding what they were doing and why they were doing. And so when you have all of it together, and so we've gone to the other side. So the other side is, let's just love and let's just study without any action, without any commitment, without any consistency. And so we're kind of gone. Now we've gone the other way, and so we're saying that that's the be all and the end all, when in truth it's really a package deal, and it's all, when you put it all together, then you can truly move along. But if you don't have the basic foundation of the relationship, if you don't have the tiny spark, if you don't have the understanding, you can do acts of love all the time. It's not going to stick. It's not going to come together. And so that's the idea of, yes, the mind, the heart, the spirit, and the action. And so all of those really have to come together. And so if you look at the four, we're really talking about all these different levels. You know, so we're talking about faith, we talk about love, we talk about emotion, we talk about consciousness, and we talk about the action. So we're really talking about, all these four verses are talking about, so they all basically, the rabbis picked up on all the four things. These are the four most important things you need in a relationship. In a relationship with God, obviously our relationship with God is a mirror of our relationship with other people, with our spouse, with our children, with our families, with friends. And so yes, the question that between them was, okay, let's, we all agree that you need all these four ingredients, but which one is most important? So it's not that one is right and one is wrong. They're all right, because you need all of these. You need all four. You can't say, well, I'll have one without the other. I'll take that one. It's not multiple choice. It's not the 10 suggestions, right? It's the 10 commandments. I mean, you need these four elements. Without it, you're incomplete. The question is, which one is most important? And each one felt that theirs, of course you need all four, but this one in some way would inspire all the others. This one said, no, this would inspire all the others. No, this would inspire all the others. This would inspire all the others. So they're really not arguing. They all agree that these are the four elements. These are what it takes. And if you have all these four elements, you're good to go. The question is, which one would be the starter? Which would be the catalyst? Which would be the one? And guess what the answer is? The catalyst is action. That's it. That's what everybody agreed. Everybody agreed, yep, yeah. If you just start doing it, everything else will come along.
Well, you have to light the match before the candle burns, right?
You know, you have to. So you have to get started. Get started. Get, you know, and you start with those actions. So obviously there has to be a tiny flame. Obviously, there has to be a point of inspiration. That's what flame is. There has to be understanding, which is the idea of education. Then there has to be application. You have to know how to apply it. And implementation. You have to start actually doing something. And then it's continuous growth. Then you start all over again. You have to inspire yourself, educate yourself, apply it, implement it, over and over again. And so those are the four worlds that we live in. Yes, Barrow.
I just did the calculation. If you did something twice a day, 13.7 years.
Say it again. If you did it two times a day.
If you did something twice a day during 65 days a year in 13.7 years, you'll have done 10,000.
Yes, that's why someone who's we pray about, 35,000 times by the time you're about 40, right? Something like that.
Yeah, we could have thought that. I came a little late, so I didn't catch. Did you make the explanation as to why sacrifice is equated to prayer? I've heard the concept before after the destruction of the second temple, that prayer is the substitute, which is why we say these passages of the sacrifices. But I didn't know if you covered how they made the connection.
Well, I didn't, but I will share this with you, that every person has an animal inside of them. We're part animal, part God. That's the definition of a human being. We're half an animal and half godly, hence the human struggle. So we have all these aspirations, creativity, and selflessness, and all that. That's God. And then we have all these animalistic things that we do, and that's because we're part animal. The idea of sacrificing an animal is taking the animal and directing all of its energy towards God. That's what a sacrifice is. That's what it means. The Hebrew word for sacrifice is karban, which means to come close. It doesn't mean to sacrifice, it means to come close. So when one wants to come close to God, how do you come close to God? Take your animal and sacrifice it. Meaning, take your animal and suck the energy that it has for all the animalistic things and direct it, to erect that energy to God. So that's what you're doing. You're basically taking the animalistic part of the person and directing it to God. When exactly are you supposed to do that during the day? What activity do we do during the day that actually engages the animal part of us and tries to redirect its energy?
Prayer.
The answer is prayer. So prayer is the time that you're supposed to take the animal that's inside of you. Now, each person has a different animal. Some people are born with a sheep, docile. Some people are born with a bull, a raging bull. Some people are born with all sorts of different types of animal instincts inside of them. And so God knows who to give what animal to whom. And so each one of us has exactly what we need, exactly what we were designed for. So obviously if you have a raging bull for an animal, obviously you're a bull tamer. So that's why you were given that. If you have a sheep, it's probably because you're a very weak person. And therefore God gave you a sheep, because that's what you can handle. So each person is given what they can handle, and it's during prayer that we're supposed to do that. Which is why it's very appropriate that the prayer is in place of the sacrifice, because it really is the same activity that we were supposed to do. So watching the animal being slaughtered and observing that was supposed to inspire and instill within the person that they should then go and take the animal inside of them and act differently. You're supposed to walk away from the sight of it changed, moved. If you weren't moved by it, then it was a, that's what, if you read the prophets, they talk about how the sacrifices had become they didn't appreciate the sacrifice anymore. It didn't change them as people. They used it as some kind of like a token.
Get out of jail free.
Exactly, get out of jail free card. Just a way to atone, but they weren't really atoning. They weren't really thinking about how they could change. They were like, oh, I did something wrong. Okay, so I'll do this, I'll do that. But they weren't really engaging in what they were supposed to be. Which is why God said, okay, you're not doing it. We'll change things up a bit over here. We'll do what we have to do in order to awaken people to that reality that they need to do, of what it is that they need to do. Yes?
So, in this sense, what's the connection with
so what God said was, number one, if you don't appreciate what it is that you have until you don't have it. So how do I get you to appreciate sacrifices? By taking them away. So on a very simple level, that's how you get someone's attention. So we didn't appreciate the sacrifices when we had them. God takes it away. All of a sudden we're like, oh my gosh, we can't wait to have the thing back. We want it back. We're starting to pray, we want it back. On another level, what God was saying was, okay, I think you guys got the wrong idea about the sacrifices. You think they just have to do an action and you're absolved and you're done. Okay, let me take that away, and since you can't bring the sacrifice, you'll be forced to have to do something else. You'll have to change inside. And so that's the other part of taking it away, saying, okay, you can't take the easy way now. The only path you have is to actually do the work. And so that's the other side of it. So God wasn't punishing us. He was simply trying to get us. He was trying to inspire us. And this was God's way of doing that. Yes?
Why three times a day instead of the two times that's in the passage?
Excellent question. So I mentioned three times a day we pray. So first of all, in the temple, there was another offering that was brought every single night. And it was kind of the, there were other sacrifices that were brought all day long. And those sacrifices were not burnt offerings. So burnt offerings meant the entire animal was burnt. But most of the other sacrifices, very little of it was burnt. But those parts would accumulate all day long, and then at the end of the day, at night, they would actually burn those. And so it's in place of that that we do the evening one. But going back, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we find that Abraham prayed in the morning, Isaac prayed in the afternoon, Jacob prayed at night. Now, why did they pray one in the morning, one in the afternoon, one in the evening? Because the same reason why we have a sacrifice in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. Because there's a certain energy that calls for prayer, calls for a certain type of prayer at that time. It's the right thing to do at that moment. And so they, being the great giants of holiness, godliness, and spirituality that they were, they just tuned right in. There's got to be a time. We should be praying now. I can just feel it. It's the morning prayer time. And so they prayed the morning prayer. He felt it's afternoon. It's time for the afternoon prayer. It's time for the evening prayer. And so when the temple came along, they put it in those time slots because that was naturally where it went. When the temple was no longer there, the prayers were now they prayed even before the temple was destroyed. People prayed three times a day. It was only then that prayer took on a whole new significance that it was also in place of the sacrifices. Yes, Janet.
This commandment is also said in Exodus, so it's not really important why the one from Numbers is picked up and the one from Exodus is not mentioned. And then I'm also thinking that animal sacrifice is like, you know, the lesson that we learned in the Binding of Isaac and the Akedah is to go away from human sacrifice, and why that isn't inaugurated in this kind of commandment. Because, I mean, God doesn't want the parents going around killing their firstborns anymore. So how come he didn't just come out and say that?
It says it very clearly all over the Torah. It's one of the it's one commandment that gets repeated over and over and over again. Don't pass your children over to Molech, which was the name of the sacrifice that they used to, sacrifice their children. So.
I think she means the animal sacrifice is something that quote outgrown.
No.
We've outgrown. What she was saying was that. It's the human.
Children.
It's the human sacrifices.
Yeah.
So Jewish people never had that problem. In other words, they were never really into human sacrifices. So when God tells Abraham to sacrifice his son, Abraham did a real double take on that one because he knew it was completely against the Torah. He knew it was completely against everything that God stood for. And he knew it was completely against what he stood for. I mean, he was supposed to be the father of the Jewish people. He only has one son, and now he's supposed to kill him. So it was a test for him, and God never told him to actually sacrifice him. God said, bring him up on the altar. So that's that was what God was just wanted to awaken within Abraham the ability to do things for God, not because you understand or appreciate them. Because everything else that Abraham did for God, he appreciated. He appreciated it. And so God wanted to bring him to a higher level where you don't only do it because you appreciate it, you do it, it's even deeper than that. It's even higher than that. And so the only thing that God could find that could possibly get him to do something for God, God had to do, it was like a trick. It was God kind of tricked him. That's what God did. God asked him to do something that God himself wouldn't have let him do. But he could only do that because he knew that Abraham would not appreciate it. And it was like bringing the sacrifice of the sheep, right? It smelled bad. It had no meaning. It was had no feeling to it. It was like the action that we were doing that was pure. Because when someone does something and appreciates it, it's not completely 100% pure. There's a little bit of us in it. And we have to rise and we have to raise ourselves to a place where we can do it purely for God. And that's what God was doing for Abraham. So it wasn't at any time that God or that Abraham thought that human sacrifices was now a good idea. As far as your first question as to why he mentions this one, not the other one, I don't know the answer. But I will look into it now that you brought it up. It may be because of just the language. Because it could be that the language is slightly different here, and that's why he uses this one, but it's a very good question. We'll look into it. Yes, Stephen.
Some people would say that Judaism is maybe too demanding and that it's hard to keep that spark of attraction when you're doing so many detailed commandments. And that,
you can get lost in the details.
You can get lost in it. So should you take on just so much and make sure you always have that spark?
That's a very, very good question and a good point. There is a statement in the Talmud that says, if you try to take on too much, you actually end up with nothing. So when your kid is trying to clear off the table and they try to grab too many things, you say, just take two things. You know, don't try to take too much. If you try to take too much, you're going to drop it all. So just take two things. Just take something small. So in our most people who overdo it, most people who overdo it is because they're doing it for themselves. Because if you would ask God, he would say, take it slow. But most people who do it, they just want to be right. They just don't want to be doing anything wrong. I don't like the feeling of being wrong. So as soon as I find out that I'm doing the wrong thing, I want to do the right thing. Not that I want to have a relationship with God. I don't like doing the wrong thing. I look at myself. I'm a good person, and I don't want to be thought of as someone who doesn't do the right thing. So, oh my gosh, this has to be. I'm doing this wrong and that wrong and this wrong and that wrong. Oh my gosh, I have so many things that I'm doing wrong. Oh, I'm breaking every law. Oh yeah, I'm such a lawbreaker. I am. It's all about me. So that's when you got to stop and you got to whoa. You got into this because of God. So why don't you ask God what does God want? And God says, one sheep in the morning, one sheep in the afternoon, slowly but surely, step by step, piece by piece, don't overdo it. Don't stop either. I usually give I heard this when I was in Australia, that I was at a rabbi for the holiday of Shavuot, I think it was. And he was saying that in the Torah it says that the altar is to be built with a ramp. No steps. You're not allowed to use steps for the altar. And he said, why? And so there are many explanations given in terms of the modesty of the priests and not embarrassing the stones. And so you're supposed to walk, you know, if you take a step, it's not so modest for the stones. And God was trying to teach us the lesson that if stones are embarrassed from our immodesty, how much more so in front of other people? But he gave this beautiful insight that stuck with me since then. I've seen it other places since, but, sometimes you hear it a certain way and it just sticks in your mind. And so he thought that it's really God teaching us how to climb the ladder of getting to God. Most of us think of it as steps, but God says, I want you to think of it as a ramp. Now with a ramp, with a step, you have to exert yourself a lot to get up the step. But once you get up to the step, you can actually rest on the step. You can actually live there for the rest of your life. But on a ramp, there is no place where you will be comfortable. But to move from one place to the next, you only have to move a quarter of a millimeter, and you've moved. So you don't have to take any big steps, but you have to keep on moving. Okay, so we're the step.
Or you roll backwards.
Or you roll backwards, right? If it's a ball, you know, you can't leave it there and then walk away. You know, you got to keep on. So if you wanna, that's the idea of the altar. It's about taking tiny steps, but never saying, oh, I got there. And the reason for it is, again, see, if I get into Judaism or if I get into religion or if I get into faith because of me, because I realize the benefit to me, so then at some point, I got enough. I got, I'm that kind of a person. I get into things that are hobbies of mine, I'm not really interested in mastering them. I just want to get it enough so that I'm good at it. I'm okay. Once I get to that level, I stop. I'm not interested. I have no interest in becoming a master guitarist. I have no interest. But I had an interest of being able to play a guitar and be able to sing along with it. As soon as I reached there, I stopped. I watch other people and I see the way they do amazing things with a guitar. It doesn't inspire me to want to become that. I don't have the time. I'm just not inspired. I got enough. You know, the same thing with almost any field that's a hobby of mine. There are certain things that are not a hobby, and those things dedicating my life to. But other things that are just a hobby, so, okay, I got it. No, I got enough out of it. Time to move on. You know, enough. I did this job for enough years. Time to move on. You know, I did this hobby for enough time. Time to move on. So when it's about me, at some point I got enough. But if it's about God, so first of all, he's not demanding too much. He didn't say how much to move. He just said to move. And I moved. I'm keeping track. I know that I moved. Last year I gave, I didn't give a penny every day to charity. This year I did. I'm moving up the ladder. I'm moving up the ramp. I know that I'm moving. How much to move? I have to go at my own pace. I have to know myself. Because I'm doing it for God. I'm not doing it for myself. And at the same time, I never stop. Because I'm not doing it for myself. I'm doing it for God. So that's the... But when someone comes along to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, I got to do it all. And I don't know why. I can't. I mean, it's so hard. Why do you have to do it all? I mean, it's wrong. I mean, it says here to do it. I said, yes, yes, yes. But it's not about you. It's about God. And God wants you to take it slow. Step by step. Step by step. Any final question?
Oh, that quote, you try to take on too much, you end up with nothing. Do you remember what attracted it?
Not off the top of my head. Yes. Yes, Michael. I didn't. We talked about that generally the Torah does describe in other places other animals. For this particular sacrifice, it's a sheep every day. And it does talk about in different places why it's specifically a sheep. But I can look that up for you. It wasn't pertinent to the... But I did look that up, and it does talk about it. Maybe after I eat, I'll remember.
It smells the worst.
Parts of it smell good. I mean, I'm not a meat person, but parts of the lamb when it's cooking smell good.
But it's an ova.
Not when you burn it. Not when it's burnt in with the bones. It's really. Yes, there were other things. There were other parts. I mean, that smelled delicious. I mean, a barbecue really smells good. I mean, when you're grilling meat, I mean, when they did the Passover sacrifice, when they were roasting those lambs, thousands of them, millions of them across Jerusalem, I mean, you could smell it for miles and miles around. It was the largest barbecue of all times.
Wasn't that one of the miracles that women didn't miscarry when Passover was...
Not Passover, it says in the temple. When they were in the temple, no woman miscarried from the smell. And it didn't smell bad, by the way. I just want you to know. It did not smell bad in the temple. So even though they were burning, that's what Beryl is referring to, even though they were burning meat and all these things and bones and stuff like that on the altar all day long, it smelled beautiful in the temple. In other words, the point is not that it smelled bad, and that the point is if God wanted something that smelled nice for aromatherapy, he would have chosen something else. So you need to have to rely on a miracle for that. Well, thank you very, very much. Jesse, you have to put in your password in order to stop the recording. Now we'll see what we're going to do with this, if we can figure out how to turn this into a recording. Again, thank you to Jesse and thank you to Steve. Jesse for putting this together, and Steve for providing the coffee.
Do it again, Jesse, it's great.
We will, definitely.
So when you do a burnt offering, it turns into carbon.